Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, August 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Clear Lake Schools received nearly $160,000 in coronavirus relief. The Clear Lake Community School District has spent almost all of its coronavirus relief bill funding. That's what Superintendent Doug G. told the Clear Lake Board of Education at a recent board meeting. The district received $95,992 from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund and about $62,800 from the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund to support its students and staff in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. Both funds are part of the U.S. government's $2.2 trillion economic relief package passed by Congress and signed into law by President Donald Trump in late March to help businesses, families, and individuals impacted by the coronavirus. The Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief, or ESSER, funds were provided to mitigate the effects of the coronavirus pandemic on elementary and secondary schools since spring. The district has used its allocation for technology, preparedness, health and safety, and payroll. More specifically, it paid for a Seesaw subscription and Zoom subscription, both of which will be used by teachers to educate students remotely, G said. The school board decided in July to return to on-site learning on August 24th. Families do have the option to voluntarily learn from home if they so choose. Other portions of the ESSER funds have been used on ordering additional sanitization and cleaning supplies, purchasing face coverings for students and staff, summer transportation costs for meal delivery, and salaries, G said. In June, Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa Department of Education announced the state received $26.2 million in Governor's Emergency Education Relief, or GEAR, funds to ensure education continues for students impacted by the pandemic. The GEAR Fund allowed governors to determine how to best meet the needs of students in public and non-public schools, post-secondary institutions, and other education-related organizations. Iowa's GEAR application was focused on providing and expanding broadband access and improving access to technology in other ways, according to the State Department of Education. The money can be used to lease Wi-Fi hotspots, provide a discount on broadband internet service, or loan devices to qualifying households, said Alyssa Pfeiffer, district business manager and board secretary. G said Clear Lake is in a unique situation with CLTEL because it has worked with the district to make sure all students and staff are connected to the internet. However, the GEAR funding will help it purchase microphones and cameras to improve the virtual learning experience. He said the district also updated some of its Chromebooks. Pfeiffer calculated Clear Lake schools saved about $67,000 from March through May, not having to pay substitute paras, teachers, and more due to the district's switch to virtual learning because of the coronavirus. G said the district also saved money by not having transportation costs from the spring activity season, but added it will likely spend what it saved and more this school year on substitutes. More state and federal coronavirus relief funding is in the works, he said. Trump visit to storm-damaged Iowa would be helpful, Grassley says. Visiting Iowa will help President Donald Trump to understand the full extent of the damage an inland hurricane caused and the ongoing recovery efforts in communities across the state, Senator Chuck Grassley said Monday morning. After Grassley spoke with the Gazette, a White House official confirmed that Trump will travel Tuesday to Cedar Rapids and meet with Governor Kim Reynolds to discuss efforts for responding to the August 10th derecho. Trump also said Monday he had approved Reynolds' request for a disaster declaration to help the state recover from the storm that caused at least $4 billion in damage. The damage Grassley saw while touring the state in recent days is unlike anything he's seen, he told the Gazette on Monday. The widespread electrical and communication outages, such damage to crops that I may have seen in a very isolated area in the past, but never from the Missouri River to the Mississippi River, he said. Grassley believes the Trump administration is well aware of the damage and Iowans' needs. He and other Iowa leaders had in-person discussions about the situation with Vice President Mike Pence, who was in Iowa on Thursday, and have been in contact with the president and his staff. Grassley exchanged text messages Sunday evening with the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, regarding Reynolds' request for a major disaster declaration. He said he would do what he could to move it along, Grassley said. Reynolds submitted the request for an expedited federal disaster declaration Sunday. According to the application, last week's derecho caused nearly $4 billion in damage, including $3.77 billion in crop damage in 36 counties. Three deaths, including that of a Solon bicyclist who was caught in the storm that included winds clocked at 140 miles per hour, are attributed to the storm. Private utilities sustained about $100 million in damage and still are working to restore electricity to Iowans who have been without power for a week. More than 8,200 homes sustained nearly $83 million in damage. Reynolds said there are more than $45 million in public assistance needs for Iowans caught in the storm's path. It also will help that Federal Emergency Management Agency Director Peter Gaynor will be in Iowa to meet with Reynolds and other officials to get a firsthand view of the damage, Grassley said. Grassley and the five other members of the Iowa congressional delegation sent a joint letter of support for the major disaster declaration to the president. Ag leaders warn Trump to back biofuels. Representatives of four influential agricultural interests Tuesday implored President Donald Trump to order his administration to make good on a promise to fully implement the federal renewable fuel standard, warning his reelection prospects in Iowa may hang in the balance. In their letter, Jim Grief, president of the Iowa Corn Growers Association, Tim Bardol, president of the Iowa Soybean Association, Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, and Brad Wilson, chairman of the Iowa Biodiesel Board, thanked Trump for coming to see firsthand the destruction wrought by a historic derecho windstorm that may have impacted up to 14 million acres of Iowa crops, and for moving quickly to approve initial disaster aid. Iowans are tough and resilient, but the scope of destruction is hard to fathom, they wrote. Today's action will assist countless Iowans to begin the long road back to normalcy. While we are appreciative of the disaster aid, rural Iowa will not complete the long road back to normal without robust and stable markets for our crops and biofuels, the four added. So we write today beseeching you to fulfill your promise to protect the RFS and to implement the program at statutory levels. According to Governor Kim Reynolds' disaster aid request, officials with the U.S. Department of Agriculture initially have projected farms in the 36 Iowa counties hardest hit by last week's windstorm sustained at least $3.77 billion in damage to 3.57 million acres of corn and 2.5 million acres of soybeans. That economic punch, along with the loss of key export markets, abuse of renewable fuel standards, or RFS, refinery exemptions by the Environmental Protection Agency, and the economic downturn resulting from COVID-19 have combined to stretch rural Iowa to its limit, the four Iowa ag leaders said in their letter. Given that economic backdrop, Grief, Bardol, Shaw, and Wilson say it is imperative for the president and his administration, most notably EPA Director Andrew Wheeler, to make good on last fall's agreement that calls for blending 15 billion gallons of ethanol and biodiesel into other motor fuels. Since then, the EPA has issued rules that Iowa elected officials, corn growers, and biofuels groups say will not fulfill the agreement reached with Trump. One senior White House official has even told us that the 15 billion gallon conventional level for the RFS was biblical to you, the four wrote. Yet, the fact of the matter is that the RFS has not actually been enforced at the statutory levels during the 4 years of your presidency. They charge the EPA has undermined the fuel rule by granting dozens and dozens of illegal refinery exemptions, destroying demand for more than 4 billion gallons of biofuels, and now is considering a plan to grant retroactive hardship exemptions for oil companies dating back as far as 2011. Mr. President, you have the power to immediately end the frustration of farmers related to biofuels and to remove all doubt of your commitment to the RFS, according to the letter, which is similar to one issued last week when Vice President Mike Pence visited Iowa. During a briefing Tuesday in Cedar Rapids by Iowa officials on the derecho storm impacts, GOP U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, who also faces re-election in November, pressed Trump to have his administration dispense with the gap year waivers by being submitted to the EPA by oil refineries in a way that we not allow them to move forward. In response, Trump told Ernst that I approved the ethanol and we did the whole thing with the 12 months and all the others. But she said farmers in Iowa's biofuels industry need help from the EPA to follow the intent of the law. All right, we'll speak to them. I'll speak to them myself. I'll do it myself, the president said. After the exchange, Iowa Democratic Party spokesperson Jeremy Bush said in a statement that Ernst was using the occasion to desperately try to cover up her vote to confirm Wheeler as EPA head in the first place. In their letter, the four ag leaders outlined what they believe the consequences will be if the president does not take more action to protect biofuels. Make no mistake, we often hear from farmers, if we can't trust the Trump administration to do the right thing before the election, then why on earth would we expect them to treat us fairly after the election? Many rural voters are waiting to see if you will uphold the RFS and your promise before the election. Iowa may very well hang in the balance, the four leaders wrote. Cerro Gordo Board of Supervisors approve appropriations change, repair work. Tuesday morning's meeting of the Cerro Gordo County Board of Supervisors was one for budgets and contracts. Neither wholly new, both added up to a little less than $100,000. On the budget side, Cerro Gordo County Budget Manager Heather Mathery informed the three-member board that an additional appropriation of $25,000 would need to go toward the County Medical Examiner's Department to cover increased expenditures on additional transportation and higher autopsy expenses. A department is not allowed to go over its appropriations, Mathery said to the board about why the change was needed. The money itself is being appropriated from the Sheriff's Department, which had money it did not spend over the course of fiscal year 2019-2020. The main contract expense that came out during the meeting is meant to address an ongoing issue at the Cerro Gordo County Courthouse. According to Director of Administrative Services, Tom Meyer, there's been a recurring problem with water coming in on the north side of the building, including on the second floor, as well as debris falling and flaking in and around the county auditor's office. It was significant enough that the county had a contractor come in the past summer to survey the matter. Now it's finally being budgeted and addressed. Meyer said that the plan is to do about $71,000 worth of tuck pointing work to hopefully eliminate the issue. The need for that particular kind of repair work is that tuck pointing helps to stop moisture and other damaging substances from getting into the brick and mortar of walls and damaging them. If the matter is relatively minor, tuck pointing will solve it. Hopefully, this will either eliminate the problem or we know it's not the tuck pointing, Meyer said. The work is expected to begin October 8th, weather permitting. New hotel opens in Forest City. A new hotel is on the block in Forest City and open and ready for customers. The Cobblestone Hotel will have its grand opening celebration Tuesday, August 18th, after nearly 10 months of construction. For the past 7 years, Forest City has been working to bring in a new hotel chain, and 5 years ago, the Cobblestone Hotel chose to build in Forest City. Forest City Economic Development Director Beth Bilieu said the city and economic development had both agreed we need a franchise because we want a hotel that is held to standards by people other than us. After a market study that showed the city can support a mid-sized hotel, such as the Cobblestone Hotel, Bilieu said the hotel franchise and the city seemed a perfect fit. We were looking for a mid-cost hotel, and Cobblestone has a good reputation in the Midwest, and plus they like markets like ours, she said. They're looking for more rural locations, more mid-sized communities, small to mid-size, and if you look at where the other Cobblestones are, we're quite similar. The groundbreaking ceremony for the hotel was held in October, and the developers were hoping to have the hotel completed and ready for business this summer in time for the Country Thunder Music Festival. Now the hotel is complete and has been open for business for about a week now, with more than 12 guests having stayed there already, according to the hotel's general manager, Nicole Peterson. "It's been going pretty good," Peterson said. "Easy. My staff, they're learning and picking it up. Some of them have had hotel experience, and some of them it's brand new for them." The two-story hotel has 47 rooms, each with a flat-screen TV, cable, coffee, tea, and free Wi-Fi, and a few of them are extended-stay rooms, complete with kitchenettes. There are also two wheelchair-accessible rooms on the first floor. The first floor also has a fitness center, a business center, and on-site laundry for the hotel guests. Though some amenities in the original design had to get tossed, such as the pool, the hotel continues to provide new, upper-class amenities, according to Peterson. "I think people are going to have to come and visit and stay with us and just find out what we're all about. And I think once they come and stay, they're going to definitely want to come back," she said. The hotel is on U.S. Highway 69, right across from the A&W and next to Borderline Pizza and Taco Jerry's. By adding 47 more hotel rooms nestled by five restaurants in the city with the 38 rooms in the Forest City Inn, Bill Yu said the hotel will enhance our tourism and keep some of the money that's coming to Forest City and then leaving at night in town. The new hotel brings a new way to help families have bigger family reunions, work with Waldorf University for when parents come into town, and host business meetings and conferences, Bill Yu said. The large space in front of the hotel will be turned into a commercial area, and the hotel was the first step toward developing the area, according to Bill Yu. "I'm looking forward to the development of the rest of the area, because usually when you do a project, it's just that site," she said. "It's kind of nice to see one that can develop into several other things as well, and it's a nice part of town. I'm looking forward to see how this enhances the business of the restaurants in the area." Caucuses again under fire as Democrats begin unusual national convention. In many ways, for Iowa's delegation, it was the first day of a Democratic national convention unlike any other, as party activists participated through video calls to kick off a convention that is being held mostly online during the global coronavirus pandemic. In other ways, for Iowa's delegation, it was the first day of a Democratic national convention just like all the others, in that it started with Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucus status under fire. National Party Chairman Tom Perez told the Associated Press on Monday, the first day of the Democratic National Convention, that he plans to use the remainder of his term to advocate for continued changes to the process by which the party's presidential nominees are selected. Among the changes enacted after the 2016 presidential elections was to push states like Iowa that hold caucuses instead of primaries to create more transparency in the caucus process. As a result, the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses for the first time included the reporting of first preference results in addition to the final delegate equivalent results. That results reporting process failed on caucus night, however, due to technical issues with a new computer program designed to tabulate the statewide results. That breakdown prompted yet another national debate over Iowa's role as the first state to cast its presidential preferences every 4 years. Perez would not comment on whether he thinks Iowa or New Hampshire, the first primary state, should give up or share their leadoff spots, the Associated Press reported. State Party Chairman Mark Smith, who was elected to the post earlier this year after previous Chairman Troy Price resigned in the wake of the caucuses, said Iowa Democrats are focused on the 2020 election and not the 2024 caucuses. "Iowa Democrats are focused on electing Democrats up and down the ticket in 78 days. Any time spent discussing the 2024 presidential election is a distraction and does not help us defeat Donald Trump," Smith said in a statement emailed by the state party. "Iowa Democrats have the momentum heading into November, boosted by record-high voter turnout, grassroots organizing, and community engagement that has put candidates up and down the ticket in a position to win." A spokeswoman said the state party was working on an official response to Perez's comments. Norm Sturzenbach, a longtime Iowa Democratic activist and former executive director of the state party, noted Perez's comments Monday reflect the national chairman's long-held opposition to caucuses. Sturzenbach noted Perez made his feelings known during meetings of the National Party's post-2016 Reform Commission. Perez has wanted to eliminate caucuses for several years at least, Sturzenbach said. This is hardly a new position for him. The 2020 Democratic National Convention was scheduled to be held in Milwaukee, but with the coronavirus pandemic looming, National Party leaders stripped the in-person convention schedule to its bare bones. Iowa's delegation, 55 activists and elected leaders from across the state, is scheduled to meet each night this week via video conference call. Monday night's featured speakers were Cory Booker, the former presidential candidate and U.S. Senator from New Jersey, and 3rd District Congresswoman Cindy Axne. Booker told the Iowa delegation that he missed spending time in the state, and he encouraged Democrats to remain vigilant during what he described as a wretched period in American history. We as a people are not defined by what happens to us. We are defined by how we choose to respond, Booker said. You all are the kind of tough, heartland people that will help our nation through the storm. Autumn Artistry's roots planted in hard work, love for community. Autumn Artistry, which marks its 20th year on Saturday, September 19th, is arguably one of the biggest events of the year for many Osage retailers and shoppers. Since its modest beginning in October 2000, with a handful of tables across a few parking lots, the artisan-centric outdoor market has blossomed into a citywide affair, garnering 100 or more vendors yearly. When asked about the inspiration behind the birth of the Eclectic Bazaar, event initiators Marcia Stricker, Jill Popp, and Dorothy Sweeney had nearly identical answers, supporting the community. The trio, who are work neighbors turned friends, each previously operated storefronts along Main Street. Stricker had the Flower Gallery, Pop had Arts, Shoe, and Repair, and Sweeney, the eponymous Sweeney's on Main. A few residents had suggested to the three that the community needed something to fill the void left by Osage's fall gathering, Maple Fest, which had faded out some years earlier. Somebody put the challenge to us to start something new, said Stricker. We each were store owners, and since we all three had a vested interest in Osage, we thought it would be fun to do something. We were all for the same thing. We were all for our town and for helping promote it, said Pop. Instead of following the typical open-air market model, the group knew they wanted to use the project as a way to shine a light on local art. After only a couple of fast weeks of tireless planning, the women settled on the name, suggested by friend Ramona Morse, and the first Autumn Artistry made its well-received debut. Being no strangers to various nonprofits reaching out for support from the business community, the group also recognized an opportunity to foster area fundraising efforts by providing booths for troops, clubs, and churches alike to sell their goods to a larger crowd. People constantly come to your door wanting something for their 4-H club or the Girl Scouts, all that kind of stuff, Sweeney said. And so we said, okay, this can also be their day too. Nearly immediately, the event's success flowed beyond the vendor booths, pouring over into the various shops and eateries that make up the downtown district. Though they've all since stepped away from the retail world and the event itself, the women's collective contribution to Main Street's small business landscape remains appreciable. Autumn Artistry brings the entire Osage business community together to welcome visitors and vendors to enjoy a wonderful day of shopping and socializing, said Osage Floral and Gifts owner Linda Winters. The impact in our store is huge because we are able to showcase our flowers and gifts to hundreds of shoppers. Many shoppers return again to shop our store going into the holiday season. While many similar street fairs are foregoing their respective seasons due to the pandemic, after careful consideration, Osage's show will go on. The first thing we did was to contact the Mitchell County Public Health Department to see what recommendations they had, said Katie Henry with the Osage Chamber of Commerce, who now organizes the event. It's our biggest event of the year, not just for us as an organization, but for the downtown, Henry said. It is important, and we want people to realize we're going to be safe about it. Henry said there were worries amongst business owners who were hit hard by COVID-19 shutdowns about whether they could count on Autumn Artistry to recoup some much-needed revenue. Some of these businesses might not make it the rest of the year if we didn't have the event, said Henry. We took that to heart when deciding to go forward with planning. The event's three creators say they're very pleased with the work Henry has been doing since handing the ropes over to her a few years back, but they also find satisfaction in their own accomplishments. You know, when you look down Main Street in your little tiny town and you see all of those people, that was gratifying, Stricker smiled. To think we could take this little tiny town and turn it into that great big city for that one day. It made me so darn proud. Campaign Almanac. Vilsack to cast Iowa's vote, candidates' caucus support, new ads. A roundup of campaign news items of interest for Tuesday, August 18th. Vilsack to cast Iowa's vote. Tom Vilsack, the former two-term Iowa governor and two-term federal agriculture secretary, was scheduled to deliver Iowa's delegate allocation during the mostly virtual Democratic National Convention. Similar to other states' representatives, Vilsack will appear via video call to announce Iowa's delegate allocation. Vilsack also planned to share best wishes for Iowans suffering as a result of last week's derecho, according to National Party guidance. Candidates' caucus support. A day after the National Democratic Party chairman said the party should eliminate caucuses from its presidential nominating process before 2024, Iowa's U.S. Senate candidates weighed in. Republican Joni Ernst, in a statement issued by her campaign, pledged her support for the caucuses and encouraged her opponent, Democrat Teresa Greenfield, to do the same. Iowans play an important and unique role in our nation's politics, and I'm going to fight to make sure it stays that way in the face of the Democratic Party's attempts to eliminate our caucuses, Ernst said. I'm calling on Teresa Greenfield to denounce her party's effort to kill Iowa's caucuses and first-in-the-nation status and diminish Iowa's voice in national politics. Will she stand with Iowans or the radical Washington Democrats bankrolling her campaign? Greenfield responded with her own pledge of support for the caucuses, and her campaign accused Ernst of using the issue as a distraction from issues like health care. Of course I support our first-in-the-nation caucuses, a tweet from Greenfield's campaign account said. The Republican Party of Iowa also issued a new release with comments from State Party Chairman Jeff Kaufman and GOP elected officials and candidates expressing their support for and defense of Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses. New Greenfield ad. The Greenfield campaign's latest TV ad once again highlights her pledge to not accept donations from corporate political organizations. Fact checkers have found that Greenfield has not accepted donations from corporate PACs, but has accepted donations from individual corporate donors and other PACs that may be funded in part by corporate donors. We need a senator who works for Iowans, Greenfield says in the ad. Greenfield calls on national media. In a statement, Greenfield called on national media to devote more coverage to the devastation caused by last week's derecho. Iowans are independent, tough, and quite frankly, we're used to people flying over and forgetting about us. But after seeing damage from the derecho storm and the delayed federal response firsthand, it's clear that the national media cannot overlook this crisis any longer, Greenfield said in a statement. Miller Meeks airs first ad. Marionette Miller Meeks, the Republican candidate in Iowa's open seat 2nd District race, is airing her first TV ad of the campaign. The biographical ad touches Miller Meeks suffering an early injury from a kitchen fire, serving in the U.S. Army, attending medical school, and serving as state public health director. Med school by day and working by night, Marionette Miller Meeks became a doctor, lieutenant colonel, then Iowa's public health director, the ad's narrator says. We need leaders who will persevere, solve problems, and get Iowans safely back to work. Miller Meeks faces Democrat Rita Hart in the 2nd District, which is open with the retirement of Democratic U.S. Representative Dave Loebsack. Hart ad highlights bipartisanship. Hart's latest ad notes her politically divided household. Hart says her father was a Democrat and her mother a Republican. So you learn pretty quick to get anything done, you've got to find common ground, like working together to grow our economy and root out wasteful spending, Hart says in the ad. I'm Rita Hart, and I approve this message because you see plenty of bull around here. We need a lot less of that from both parties in Washington. Young's first ad up. David Young, the Republican candidate seeking a return to Congress, is up on TV in Iowa's 3rd District race, and the topic is health care. The ad tells the story of Allie Steele, a young West Des Moines girl whose health insurance was not covering treatment for her rare congenital anomaly, according to the Young campaign. Young introduced legislation that would require insurance companies to cover the treatments. I know David Young will fight for Iowans with pre-existing conditions because he did for me, Allie says in the ad. Young faces first-term Democratic incumbent U.S. Representative Cindy Axne in a rematch of the 2018 3rd District race. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for Tuesday, August 18, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Terrell Terry Wilson Menzel, 1924 to 2020. Terrell Terry Wilson Menzel, age 95, was born in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, on September 15, 1924. In 1 month, he would have celebrated his 96th birthday. Terry died on Tuesday, August 11th, in Bellevue, Nebraska. Terry was a graduate of P.J. Jacobs High School in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he earned his MBA in risk and insurance. He was a gifted athlete throughout high school and college, lettering in football, hockey, basketball, and tennis. In later years, Terry was an avid golfer, and he was proud of his 2 holes-in-1. Terry was a radio man in the U.S. Navy during World War II on the aircraft carrier Franklin D. Roosevelt. He received the American Campaign Good Conduct and Victory Medals for his service to his country. He married Rosemarie Love Menzel on July 9, 1949. Terry and Rose enjoyed 65 years together. They were blessed with 4 children, Barbara of Everett, Washington, Sally of Kaneiho, Hawaii, Nancy of Winchester, Oregon, and Ted of Bellevue, Nebraska. Terry and Rose had 11 grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren, with 2 more on the way. Terry held a variety of jobs in the insurance industry in Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. He was also active in the following community organizations: YMCA, Junior Achievement, Chamber of Commerce, Lions Club, Elks Club, American Legion, and the American Red Cross, where he donated over 40 gallons of blood. Preceded in death by his wife, Rosemarie Love Menzel, parents A.A. Ted and Myrtle Menzel, and brother Robert Menzel. He is survived by his children, Barbara Menzel and partner John Van Wagenen, Sally McCulley and spouse Paul, Nancy Sanderson and spouse Rodney, Ted Menzel and spouse Cindy, 11 grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren. Visitation is Saturday, August 22nd from 9 to 10:30 a.m., followed by Mass of Christian Burial at 10:30 a.m., both at St. Mary's Catholic Church, 2302 Crawford Street in Bellevue. The private interment service will be held in Stevens Point, Wisconsin at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials to the American Red Cross of Portage County, Wisconsin. Military honors by U.S. Navy Honor Guard and American Legion Post 331. Go Green Bay Packers and on Wisconsin. Joseph A. Medlin, 1949 to 2020. Joseph Joe A. Medlin, 71, a Brit, passed away Monday, August 17th at Westview Care Center in Brit. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Visitation will be held from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Wednesday, August 19th at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 101 North 4th Street in Clear Lake. Memorial contributions may be directed to John Mendelin. Joe was born on May 21st, 1949 in Mason City, son of Alvin and Viola Bolin Medlin. He graduated from Clear Lake High School, class of 1967. After graduation, Joe enlisted into the Marines and served in Vietnam and was honorably discharged in 1971. He worked in Charles City for White Farm for several years and then began working at Snyder Metal in Mason City. In 1993, he and his family moved to Altoona and he worked at Prairie Meadows until his retirement. In 2010, Joe moved back to the Clear Lake area to enjoy his retirement. Joe was a member of the Clear Lake VFW. He enjoyed many sports, including the Iowa Hawkeyes, Minnesota Twins, and Vikings. While living in Altoona, he loved helping his boys with their activities. He will be remembered for his love of sports and would never turn a beer down. Joe is survived by his 3 children, Bobby Joe Medlin of Mason City, Benjamin Medlin of Mason City, and John Medlin of Mason City. Two sisters, Julie Rubalcava and Connie Strom. Two grandchildren, Oliver and Tony Medlin, and many extended family and friends. He is preceded in death by his parents, Alvin Medlin and Viola Merle Christensen. The family would like to thank the Westview Care Center for their wonderful care throughout the years. Hugh Whitesell, 1928-2020. Hugh Whitesell of Nora Springs and formerly of Mesa and Sedona, Arizona, went to be with the Lord on August 15th at the age of 92. He was born on June 29th, 1928, to Roy and Nellie Whitesell. After graduating from Mason City High School, he attended X-ray training at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, where he met and married Clarice Chris Rula. They moved to Nora Springs, where they raised their family. Hugh is survived by his three children, Cheryl Gigstad and spouse Nelson, John Whitesell and spouse Michelle, and Susie Bratrud and spouse Randy, along with eight grandchildren and several great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by Chris in 1969. Later, he married Mary Ann Jensen, and they moved to Mesa, Arizona. Mary Ann preceded him in death in 1999. He is survived by her three children, Joel Jensen and spouse Irene, Mary Jane Lionberger, Jennifer Ceccarelli and spouse Dean, four grandchildren, and several great-grandchildren. Later, he moved back to Nora Springs, where he was active in the United Methodist Church and the Nora Springs Historical Society. Memorials may be made to North Iowa Hospice, American Cancer Society, or Lime Creek Nature Center. A graveside service will be held in Nora Springs, and later a memorial in Sedona, Arizona. Hugh requested that Psalm 23 be used at his service. Clayton Thunder D. Traeger. Clayton Thunder D. Traeger, 64 of Dubuque and formerly Alexander, passed away on Friday, August 14th at Bethany Home in Dubuque. Graveside services for Clayton Thunder Traeger will be held at 2:30 p.m. on Tuesday, August 18th at Emmanuel Reformed Church Cemetery, 3157 130th Street in rural Belmont. Visitation will be held from 1 to 2:15 p.m. on Tuesday, August 18th at Ewing Funeral Home, 111 Lewix Lane South in Belmont. Cheryl L. Denny. Cheryl L. Denny, 69, of Garner, passed away peacefully on Saturday, August 15th at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice Unit in Mason City. Funeral services will be held 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 21st at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Garner, with Reverend Scott Kozasek officiating. Burial will be at Concord Township Cemetery in Garner. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Cataldo Funeral Chapel, 160 East 4th Street in Garner, and will resume 1 hour prior to services at the church. Masks are encouraged and social distancing guidelines will be followed. William P. Bill Korleski, 1944-2020. William P. Bill Korleski, 75, of Clear Lake, passed away from complications of acute myeloid leukemia Friday, August 14th at Mayo Clinic Hospital, Methodist Campus in Rochester, Minnesota, with his family by his side. A memorial service will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 22nd at the Surf Ballroom, 460 North Shore Drive in Clear Lake, with Reverend Father John Gossman officiating. The service will be live-streamed on the Cataldo Funeral Home Facebook page. Private interment will be at L Township Cemetery in Clemmie. Visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 21st at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. Both the visitation and memorial service are casual dress and your favorite team if you prefer. Masks are required and social distancing guidelines will be observed. In lieu of flowers, memorials are suggested to the Clear Lake Fishing Club, Pheasants Forever, or Ducks Unlimited. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. William Patrick Korleski, the son of William and Patricia O'Leary Korleski, was born October 23, 1944, in Santa Ana, California. Bill grew up in Emmitsburg until moving with his family to Lake City at the age of 14. He graduated from Lake City High School in 1963 and continued his education for a year at Iowa State University. On February 20th, 1965, he married Mary Ellen Kelly. They made their home in Clemmy, where Bill operated Korleski Locker and Grocery Store. Bill later closed the grocery business and started a federal meat processing plant, Cor Burt, in 1979. After Mary passed away in 1987, he continued to live in Clemmy until moving to Clear Lake in 1989. In 1993, Bill and Mary Ann purchased a plant in Webster City, which became Mary Ann's Specialty Foods. On February 10, 1994, he married Mary Ann Glue at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Clear Lake, where they lived. Bill was known for being a pioneer in the meat industry and a mentor to many. To his family and friends, he was the warm, welcoming force that made everyone feel at home. He could often be seen serving delicious whole hog barbecues or other meat creations for friends and family, as well as local community events. To many, he'll be remembered for Cor Burt brand ham, bacon, and sausage, and the vast private branded products that sold throughout the United States and many countries around the world. An avid Iowa State Cyclone supporter, he and Mary Ann enjoyed many tailgates and trips to follow their favorite team. You would know their tailgate for the yummy bacon, ham, or sausage. When not at a game, you'd often find him piloting a plane or on his pontoon boat or at their farm. Bill loved taking trips, traveling to Germany, Austria, Italy, and Mexico. He was always outdoors, hunting in Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming, as well as fishing in Canada, northern Minnesota, Alaska, and Florida. Bill was a member of St. Patrick's Catholic Church and Knights of Columbus. He also belonged to the Clear Lake Fishing Club, Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, and the Iowa State Cyclones Club. Bill is survived by his wife, Mary Ann of Clear Lake, two children, Pam Netzel and spouse Paul of Des Moines, and Kelly Korleski and spouse Jody of Clear Lake, grandchildren, Colin and Aaron Coffey and Courtney and Rachel Formanek, siblings, Jane Graham and partner Bruce Sankey of Garner, Jim Korleski and spouse Karen of Boone, Pat Ritter and spouse Randy of Clemmy, Nancy Musburger and spouse Jim of Sac City, Barb Blair and spouse Marvin of Lake City, Don Korleski and spouse Brenda of Lake City, Dick Korleski and spouse Bonnie of Clemmy, and Frank Korleski and spouse Sherry of Simpsonville, South Carolina, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, first wife Mary, brother Bob, sister-in-law Bev Korleski, brother-in-law Earl Graham, son-in-law Mike Coffey, and nephew Jason Bonner. Mary Lou Kellogg, 1942-2020. Mary Lou Kellogg, 78, of Charles City, passed away following a courageous battle with cancer on Friday, August 14th, at the Iowa River Hospice House in Marshalltown with her loving family at her side. To honor her wishes, cremation rites have been accorded and no public services are planned. A memorial fund is being established. The Mitchell Family Funeral Home in Marshalltown has been entrusted with caring for Mary and her family. For further information or to leave her family a condolence, please visit mitchellfh.com, and that's mitchellfh.com, or call 641-844-1234. Mary was born on January 4, 1942 in Charles City, the daughter of Lyle and Cecilia Schilling Kellogg. She grew up and graduated high school in Charles City. Mary's passion was helping others. She was a foster grandmother for the first through fourth graders at the Charles City Public Schools for many years, and she became widely known as Grandma Mary. In 2018, she earned the Foster Grandparent of the Year for her untiring dedication and work. Mary also enjoyed word search puzzles and loving her family and all others. Left to cherish her memory is her son, Sean Kellogg, and spouse Tammy. Three grandchildren, Jacqueline Kellogg, Trent Potter, and Kaylee Potter. Great-grandchildren, Amelia, Ariana, Lonnie, and Riley, and her brother, Roger Kellogg, and spouse Kitty. In eternal life, Mary has been reunited with her parents. Alice A. Bryant. Alice A. Lewin Bryant, 85, of Plymouth, Minnesota, formerly of Goodall, passed away Saturday, August 15th, at Cornerstone Assisted Living in Plymouth, Minnesota. Graveside service for Alice Bryant will be Saturday, August 22nd at 1 p.m. at the Amsterdam Cemetery in Goodall. Those planning to attend the graveside service are invited to bring a lawn chair. Those in attendance will be asked to follow social distancing guidelines and encouraged to wear a face covering. Mason City Golf falls to Ankeny in season opener. The North Iowa fall sports season kicked off on Monday as the Mason City Golf team hosted Ankeny at Highland Park Golf Course. The Hawks took down the Mohawks to snag their first win of the year, 296-378. Ankeny's Dylan Taylor finished with the day's top score with a 70. For Mason City, junior Ryan Berkeley had the best score with an 86. Freshman Drew DeGabriel was close behind at 89, while juniors Aiden Thompson and John Brandt had respective scores of 97 and 106. The Mohawks' next match will be at Highland Park on Friday at 10 a.m. against Ames. Waldorf Hockey adds standout Blake Spidell. The Waldorf hockey team added a defensive standout to the squad just a few weeks before the team is scheduled to begin preparing for a new season. Forest Lake, Minnesota native Blake Spidell will begin his freshman year this fall as a member of the Warriors. Spidell totaled 1 goal and 12 assists over the past 3 seasons for Forest Lake High School. This past season, he played in 25 games and assisted on 4 goals as the team advanced to the Minnesota sectional semifinals. We are very pleased to welcome Blake to our program. He is a steady, all-around defenseman with a good skill set that will translate well to the college level, Waldorf head coach Brett Schlansky said. Blake comes from a very solid high school program in Minnesota. He makes good decisions with the puck and is a calm and steady presence on the back end. New look West Hancock football team set to begin state title defense. On a recent hot August morning, the West Hancock football team emerged from the locker room ready to start practice and eager to begin defending its Class A state title. Things will look very different for the Eagles this season. Due to COVID-19, the team will stay socially distanced in practice, sanitize constantly during games, and play a 7-game schedule as decreed by the Iowa High School Athletic Association. But even beyond the pandemic-caused adjustments, a lot will change for the Eagles. 2 members of the team's three-headed monster at running back graduated this past year, in Tate Hagen and Joseph Smith. 4 starters on the vaunted offensive line are gone, as well as starting quarterback Braden Lehrer. Those departed players helped lead the Eagles to a state-best 5,312 yards rushing yards last season, 720 yards more than second-place St. Ansgar. The Eagles also finished with a state-high 6,825 all-purpose yards. The team will return starting right guard Tanner Thompson, split end Matthew Francis, and running back Cole Kelly, but the rest of the offense will be made up of young players and new starters. Did we lose a lot? Absolutely, head coach Mark Sanger said, but we've also got a lot of kids underneath that are ready for their shot. We have a lot of unknowns about who are going to be those people that step up. That's an exciting part of it, to see who it is. Kelly ran for 1,184 yards last season, good for 3rd best on the team. He is the only returning starter at the position and will take on a leadership role in the backfield. While Kelly might not have the outspoken nature of someone like Hagen, Sanger expects him to set the tone. He will definitely be a leader on offense, Sanger said. He's more of a learn-by-doing guy. Cole is a guy that is not going to be outworked. He's got a work ethic that is second to none. I don't think quiet leadership is the right word, but you just watch how he does it. The line that will block for Kelly this season does not have nearly the experience or size of the previous group. The 2019 line played together for 3 seasons and was known as an especially big and bruising crew. While there will surely be an adjustment period and maybe a growing pain or two, Kelly isn't nervous about coming into the season with practically a whole new line. Yeah, those guys last year were really good and played together and were really good at communicating, but I'm going to give these guys a shot, Kelly said. You should never turn the cheek on anybody. They've put in the work. They're not as big, but they'll do a good enough job. We're doing the same thing as we did last year with our footwork and how we did our reps with the plays. I think we'll be fine with them. One new addition to the line is Alex Marks, who comes to the Eagles from Garcias Memorial High School in Bakersfield, California. Marks moved to Britt once the fall sports season in California was postponed and brings plenty of size and strength to the team. He's a nice kid, Sanger said. We've had a week and a half with him, but obviously we can tell he's been coached before. We'll see, but it's going to be just like anybody else. He's going to have to earn the spot he's going to get. The one sure thing on this year's line is Tanner Thompson. Thompson is the O-line's only returning full-time starter, and Sanger expects him to bring the same vocal and fiery brand of leadership that he brought to the team in 2019. While Thompson knows he will need to be patient with his fellow linemen this season, he doesn't expect them to struggle all that much. Prior to their 21-17 victory over Grundy Center in the state title game, the Eagles beat all of their opponents by at least 22 points, giving the young players plenty of time to get late-game snaps. "We're going to be a little bit smaller, a little bit inexperienced," Thompson said. "We're going to have to use our athleticism to outdo the size that we lost. Last year, we had a bunch of kids getting playing time since we were outscoring so many people. There was a lot of experience that they got from last year." This past Friday, the team went through its stretches and practiced tackling techniques in the cool Brett morning air. Games will start in just a few weeks, beginning a unique season in which every team will make the playoffs. After an emotional roller coaster of a year that saw both a Class A state title and the death of longtime West Hancock head coach Bob Sanger, the team is eager to finally get back on the football field and try to win consecutive state titles for the first time in program history. Though things will look different, Mark Sanger is confident that his team has a chance to make another deep playoff run. "We have a lot of question marks we have to figure out, but we absolutely have a team that is capable of making a run to the playoffs," Sanger said. "That is the easiest way I can say it. We have the pieces we can put together to have a very successful season. Time will tell whether we get where we want to be or not." West Hancock will open its season at home on August 28th against Garner Hayfield Ventura. Virus review. Senate Republicans preparing $500 billion relief proposal. More universities go remote. Senate Republican leaders are preparing a slimmed-down virus relief package of nearly $500 billion that will include extended payments for unemployed people and smaller businesses, a GOP senator said Tuesday. The package will also include $10 billion for the embattled Postal Service, said one top GOP aide. The agency has become the focus of a campaign season battle over whether it will have enough resources to handle an expected flood of mail-in ballots for this November's presidential and congressional elections. The fight between President Donald Trump and congressional Democrats has become a critical political battle that weaves together Trump's troubled handling of the coronavirus pandemic and the deeply wounded economy. Negotiations over a far larger coronavirus relief bill are expected to resume after Labor Day between the White House and top congressional Democrats. With Democrats demanding that bargainers piece together a wide-ranging measure, the trimmer package emerging from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, and other top Republicans, seems to be an effort to show voters what the GOP would favor enacting quickly. In other developments, the virus that closed down North Carolina's flagship public university is making its mark on colleges and college towns around the United States. Some universities are reconsidering plans to hold in-person classes or implementing new testing regimens. Others are threatening crackdowns on students who get too close with others in violation of social distancing rules. The University of Notre Dame on Tuesday canceled in-person undergraduate classes for 2 weeks after a spike of coronavirus cases that occurred since the semester began August 10th. Michigan State University also canceled all in-person instruction for the fall semester. Facing mounting public pressure and a crush of state lawsuits, President Donald Trump's new Postmaster General announced Tuesday he is halting some operational changes to mail delivery that critics blamed for widespread delays and warned could disrupt the November election. With the Trump administration openly trying to undermine mail-in voting this fall, some election officials around the country are hoping to bypass the Postal Service by installing lots of ballot drop boxes in libraries, community centers, and other public places. More than half a dozen cities, counties, and civil rights groups have sued the Trump administration, saying there was no justification for its decision to cut the 2020 census short by a month during a pandemic. Wall Street clawed back the last of the historic frenzied losses unleashed by the new coronavirus as the S&P 500 closed at an all-time high Tuesday. The pandemic has accelerated a power shift in the fashion and advertising world, with models and influencers by necessity wielding more control over their own images during remote photo and video shoots. Whether college football players play a lot in the fall, a little in the spring, or not at all over the next 10 months, some athletic administrators want to give them all a mulligan on the 2020-2021 season in terms of eligibility. Americans turned to Walmart and Home Depot for supplies and do-it-yourself projects as they stayed close to home at a time when new cases of virus surged, resulting in soaring sales for their fiscal second quarter. Rates of depression appear to have almost doubled in Britain since the country was put into lockdown in late March as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, according to the country's official statistics agency. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, August 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.